Welcome all to this podcast. This podcast relates to the Purdue Pharma case, a major U.S. Supreme Court insolvency decision that was issued on June 27 in 2024, and it is heard around the world. We have two speakers with us, Brett Axelrod and Brittany Michael. And Brett and Brittany, may I ask you to introduce yourself to our public?
Absolutely, and thank you. Brett Axelrod, I am the managing partner of Fox Rothschild's Las Vegas office and a past co-chair of the National Financial Restructuring and Bankruptcy Department, and I specialize in Chapter 11 debtor side work.
Hi, I'm Brittany Michael. I'm senior counsel at Pacholsky, Stang, Zeal & Jones, and I specialize in representing tort creditors committees in mass tort bankruptcies.
And I'm Juan Tan. I'm an officer in the insolvency section of the International Bar Association and currently one of the co-chairs. And I was asked to moderate this session. Thank you, Brett and Brittany, and welcome to all of our listeners. Let's start with what we are discussing, what we'll be discussing today. But before we get into the meat of the ruling, Brett, would you please set the stage for us?
Absolutely. In September of 2019, Purdue Pharma LP and 23 affiliated debtors filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, given the mounting pressures from 2,900 state and federal lawsuits, as well as multiple investigations by various arms of the Justice Department. As part of the Chapter 11 cases, the Purdue Pharma debtors, its owners, and certain other parties entered into a settlement agreement whereby the owners would contribute $6 billion to fund the plan to repay creditors, including the opioid claimants. In exchange for the settlement funds, the owners were to receive releases from all claims from both the debtors and any third party that could bring a claim against the owners. The release by the third parties would enjoin all claims, regardless of whether the third party claimants voted to approve the plan. The total of the claims filed were 614,000 that were seeking $140 trillion in recovery. The debtors received 120,000 votes in favor of the plan, which represented 95% of creditor approval, including 97% of state and local government approval of the plan.
This is massive. This is huge. I assume this is huge for U.S. standards as well. We did get an overview of this case at the IBA Insolvency Section's annual conference in 23 in Madrid, that there was a major circuit split brewing. Can you tell us about that?
Happy to. Prior to the Supreme Court decision, there was a split amongst the federal circuits, whereby six circuits, including the Second and Third Circuits, allowed third-party releases upon a showing of special circumstances. To contrast that, three circuits, including the Fifth, the Ninth, and the Tenth, did not allow third-party releases. And then we had the First and the Eighth Circuits undecided on the issue.
So that sounds like we had a quite a debate amongst the judges themselves, apart from the debates between the lawyers. And when you talk about third-party releases, I think it's good for our international listeners to explain what that means. Would you please do that?
Absolutely. It is both a release and injunction that is part of the Chapter 11 plan, effectively seeks to discharge claims against a non-debtor, a third party who has not filed for bankruptcy itself. In the Purdue case, you had the equity ownership that had received over $11 billion from the operation of the Purdue Pharma, and they were seeking to get that release for paying the $6 billion that we talked about earlier in the plan and not exposing all of their assets and everything they had received as part of it.
If you talk about those released parties, who are generally the released parties under this plan or under normal circumstances in other cases a plan?
In release parties, what you're looking to accomplish is a stay of all litigation. And so typically you will have anyone who's financing the case, known as the debtor in possession financing lender, the debtors, secured creditors, the plan sponsor, which may or may not be equity. And most importantly, in this case, it was the state governments, the tribal governments, and the tort victims.
So they will all be bound by the plan if it would be a success. Brittany, if I may change to you, would you please summarize the Purdue Pharma Supreme Court decision we are talking about of June 27? And how did the Supreme Court ultimately rule on this case?
Sure. So continuing your observation that there was a debate among the judges themselves on this issue at the circuit level, the Supreme Court ultimately ruled in a 5-4 decision. The majority was Gorsuch, who was the author of the majority opinion, Alito, Thomas, Barrett, and Jackson. And the dissent was Kavanaugh, Roberts, Sotomayor, and Kagan. It's an interesting split for those who follow the U.S. Supreme Court. It did not split along ideological or party lines the way our Supreme Court decisions often do. The majority decision ruled that non-consensual third-party releases are not allowed under the bankruptcy code. In their ruling, they emphasized that non-consensual releases are not allowed. What their ruling did not decide is whether consensual releases under the bankruptcy code are allowed, whether full satisfaction plans are allowed, so plans that allege to pay all claimants in full. As noted here, the claims allege over $20 trillion in monies owed, and so there was no argument that the monies that were to be paid under the Purdue Pharma plan would have been payment in full. And the decision did not address plans that have already gone effective and been substantially consummated, so the money has gone out to the creditors. So what the majority did look to is they emphasized that typically in bankruptcy, a discharge or a release is given to a debtor because that debtor puts virtually all of its assets on the table. And repeatedly, the majority noted that the Sacklers were not putting close to all of their assets on the table for the release that they were getting. They also noted that the Sacklers were getting releases that may even be broader than what a debtor could get in bankruptcy, because the Sacklers were getting releases of fraud and willful misconduct claims, whereas individual debtors in bankruptcy cannot be discharged for fraud and willful misconduct claims. And the majority was particularly concerned at the idea that individuals who were not subject to the bankruptcy court's jurisdiction had not filed a proof of claim in the bankruptcy, those who might come forward in the future, or those who might have litigation but chose not to file claims in the bankruptcy, would be released under the Purdue Pharma plan. So ultimately, the majority said that third-party releases are not allowed. One other thing that the majority said that I think is worth noting, it's in a footnote, and it's somewhat dicta, but the bankruptcy code has a section, section 105A, that gives bankruptcy courts broad powers to take any action in furtherance of the bankruptcy code. And section 105A is often what was relied on for third-party releases, and any matter of other relief that has been developed by bankruptcy courts to assist bankruptcy matters. And the Supreme Court noted in footnote 2 of the decision that section 105 serves only to carry out authorities expressly conferred elsewhere in the code, whereas other courts have interpreted 105 to give bankruptcy courts authority to do anything that wasn't expressly disallowed by the code. And so that might have far-reaching implications beyond even just third-party releases.
This sounds very complex for lawyers and for judges to decide on. And one part that struck me is the item of consent, and how did the concept of consent play in this case a pivotal role in the Supreme Court's decision?
The majority decision repeatedly notes its concern that creditors who did not consent to the releases would be bound by them. As is often the case, the Supreme Court, however, did not provide the judges and attorneys that are going to be interpreting this decision any guidance really on what they consider consent and what they consider non-consensual releases. So while they left open to another day whether consensual releases are allowed under the bankruptcy code, they didn't tell us what those consensual releases might look like. So already some courts in the US have been grappling with what a consensual release looks like. In the past, there have been two main options for consenting releases. There have been plans that went out to creditors for vote that said, if you do not opt out of this plan, you will be deemed to have consented to the releases. Or there were plans that went out to creditors and said, you have to actively opt in to the releases of this plan. Otherwise, you won't be bound by the plan. You might also not receive payment under the plan if you don't opt in. But those are often the opt-in versus opt-out options. What we have already seen judges at the bankruptcy court level deciding is that creditors need to take affirmative action to be bound by third-party releases going forward. So they must opt in to the plan. That simply saying silence is consent is not enough under the Supreme Court's decision in Purdue Pharma.
In my words, does that mean that while preparing bankruptcy agreements, is the predictability, is that now less than before? And do we expect more litigation? I hear that from your words. Is that correct?
I would say absolutely. It's now creditors have a lot more power in the bankruptcy, especially the outspoken minority creditors, because if they choose to not opt in, then the whole predictability and finality that a bankruptcy plan used to provide, not just for the debtor, but for all of those potential released parties that Brett outlined earlier, now goes somewhat into disarray because a stubborn, vocal minority of creditors could continue litigation after the bankruptcy and not be forced to be bound by the majority. Or, you know, looking at Purdue Pharma, you had over 99% creditor support for the plan. And so it's really a very vocal minority that derailed the whole process.
Yes, and that will probably create, even only in this case, more litigation, and let alone the question where the money will flow in for the creditors. But if you look at this case from a distance, how does this decision uphold the right of creditors to participate in bankruptcy negotiations? Because on one side, you have the non-voting creditors, and on the other side, you have the creditors that did agree to the proposals, and they're obviously will not get their monies in the short term. What is your view in this?
One thing that the majority opinion notes is while the voting creditors in Purdue Pharma overwhelmingly supported the plan, only 20% of creditors eligible to vote actually voted. So going forward, there's going to have to be broader creditor engagement, which is going to put a lot of burden on the plan proponents. When you have case of Purdue Pharma, over 100,000 creditors, getting all of those creditors to be engaged, to opt in to releases, to opt into plans. And it's going to give creditors more rights to hold up the process to the extent there are third parties involved. Obviously, this doesn't change the relationship between the creditor and the debtor that's actually in bankruptcy.
So it will be more time consuming. Is that the
Yes.
relevance? Is that the significance of this ruling, or is there more to it?
I think that's a major significance of this ruling. It's giving that megaphone to dissenting creditors, the need to increase creditor engagement across the board in these cases, and perhaps come up with new creative solutions to get entities releases through the bankruptcy process that isn't as easy and clean cut as third party releases.
So lots to talk about and all new debates, and perhaps we should start doing a debate amongst ourselves. And one of the questions I have for you two is, what have been the practical implications and ramifications of the ruling? Do you have a view on that?
Oh, absolutely. What we have is that we will see that the US trustee who oversees bankruptcy cases is going to continue to do an objection anytime they, you know, see releases, you know, and they're going to be the gatekeeper to see if this meets the threshold of consent with appropriate opt-out provisions. And then you're going to have the courts weighing in. They're already, you know, weighing in. An example is the Bowflex case for the Bowflex equipment, where the court held that the U.S. trustee's objection to the third-party releases should be overturned because of the releasing parties had such conspicuous notice and had an opt-out process that ended up satisfying, you know, due process. You're also going to have the situation where typically when you file a bankruptcy and if you're going to have third-party releases or plan sponsor, they don't want to be sued while they're trying to formulate a plan and build creditor consent. And so we call these gatekeeping injunctions, basically to pause litigation during this process. And it's whether or not our court's going to still grant those gatekeeping injunctions. So you have that time to formulate a plan, or in light of Purdue, are they going to say, look, ultimately, you're not going to be able to get the third-party releases, so we're not going to give you that breathing room during the beginning part of the case.
So there's more leverage for the small creditors. Brittany, do you have anything to add to that or comments on that?
No, I think that was a very good summary. I wholeheartedly agree that one of the most practical implications is the empowerment of the U.S. Trustee's Office following this, probably on this issue and many others, while U.S. trustee really led the charge with the objections to the Purdue Pharma case, again, because there was such overwhelming creditor support and generally often is a voice in U.S. bankruptcies that even if all the other parties to the bankruptcy case agree, stands out. And while bankruptcy judges might overrule them, they now are more empowered on the appellate level as well.
Oh, sorry to interrupt there, and I was just thinking, would it be good for our international public to explain what the tasks of the U.S. trustees?
Absolutely. It's somewhat confusing in the U.S. bankruptcy system because we have the U.S. trustee, and in some cases we'll have a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 11 trustee as well. The U.S. trustee is a branch of the U.S. Justice Department whose job it is to enforce the bankruptcy code and generally protect the rights of the public in any bankruptcy proceeding. So in Purdue Pharma, while there were a few creditors who also objected, the main objectors to the plan was the U.S. trustee's office. So even though the creditors committee, the creditors, the debtor, all of the other parties were on board with the plan, the U.S. trustee, in the role as upholding the public's interest in following the bankruptcy code, was the voice that led the charge against third-party releases. And we've seen, you know, the U.S. trustee more actively engaging in cases now, having received this big win in overturning third-party releases through the Purdue Pharma decision.
So interestingly, it is either you qualify what happened here as very democratic or not. And I'm, from a European perspective, I'm not sure what it is. But we'll talk through the international aspects later or now. How might the principles established in the Purdue case impact cross-border insolvencies, cross-border bankruptcy proceedings, and the position of international creditors? Do you have a view on that?
Sure. From a debtor's perspective, if I, am going to file a case that has mass torts, I'm going to look, if it's an international company, to a friendlier international forum such as England that allows for the non-consensual third-party releases. I will file the case there, and then I will seek a Chapter 15, which is a recognition in the U.S. courts for a foreign main proceeding to be able to get this type of plan still approved. Because when you file a Chapter 15 in the United States, you are not having the same issues with the Department of Justice, with the U.S. trustee, and they're looking more to the foreign jurisdiction. So if that is on the table based on the how the debtor is organized, that is certainly something that can be taken into consideration. When it comes to how this is going to affect international creditors, they now have a greater voice, just like the US creditors. And they can be the holdout to try and squeeze for more money in order to give a release.
So basically, we have new business in forum shopping, and we in Europe or wherever in the world, as long as the US accepts our decisions, should be open for discussions and try to create some business out of it. But this is not what we're talking today. On another international topic, do you have any views on what might be the impact of the Purdue decision in international aspects or practices in the bankruptcy law? For instance, in the Netherlands, we don't have the explicit option of third-party releases. However, we try to implement it by creating an agreement where, for instance, the officers are acquitted. But what would the impact be? And we all know that what happens in the US will happen in Europe 2 years later. Do you have any view on what international lawyers, and not only Europe, could learn or should learn from this decision?
I think it's going to be following the lower courts and as they go through the appeals on what is deemed to be appropriate consent and what will satisfy due process to take that as best practices to then incorporate in the European, or other forums bankruptcies, because I think that is going to be the trend, is giving the creditors their voice, even if they're the holdout creditors.
I agree with Brent. I think another thing that will be interesting to watch in addition to the courts is what the US Congress does. The Supreme Court's decision was entirely focused on whether the bankruptcy code as it is written today allows third-party releases. It left the door wide open for Congress to amend the bankruptcy code to codify third-party releases. So I think another kind of broader implication is the idea that if you're going to have this kind of relief, at least in the US, it needs to be written into the law versus created by judges. So to the extent other jurisdictions start looking to what their law says versus, what judges choose to actually do, that might be an implication if US Congress goes forward and tries to bring 30 third-party releases back into the bankruptcy code.
And what's really interesting is that we already have a provision in the bankruptcy code under the mass torts of the asbestos litigation that specifically provides for it. So it's a very easy fix for Congress, to include asbestos and other, tort cases as an example. rather than a laboring drafting war. And what has occurred that got us to this point is that practitioners were borrowing from the asbestos logic and applying it to mass torts, so it'd be a very easy fix.
Oh, that's interesting. We will follow that. I have a last question for you, and that's quite general. That is, do you think within the short time frame we have today that we have touched on what we now think are the most interesting issues that were created by the Purdue Pharma decision, or are there any additions or remarks you want to make now at this point?
The only thing to point out is that when you look at the people with financial stake in the game, they were the ones who wanted this plan. They were the ones willing to give up some economic advantages for certainty and for an immediate cash payment. But what we have is we have a political watchdog, who doesn't have financial skin in the game. Who decided to appeal this decision, and really it does upend the ability and the flexibility to deal with these tragedies that are mass torts and to get the victims money quickly.
Yeah, I think following what Brent said, part of one thing we haven't really touched on is Purdue Pharma was a mass tort case looking at to solve a very complicated situation that involved, hundreds of thousands of people across the country. Third-party releases have been used in other contexts in bankruptcy cases, and I think going forward, we'll see solutions to provide releases for officers and directors, possibly taking a different path than the solutions that are created to continue to deal with these sort of catastrophic mass tort cases.
In other words, the people that suffered will not get the monies or damages paid in the short term. That's the choice that the Supreme Court made here, because if they just had decided otherwise, we would have seen the end of it shortly and money's paid out shortly, relatively shortly, while now we have to wait and see what happens and whether monies will flow into the case or not at the end of the day.